Dancing. What do? Range of motion. Okay. She's got pretty much the same range as she's always had. Look for an infection. Okay. No signs of infection. What else? For those of you who didn't hear that, it was definitely worth sharing. The answer was, change the music. We want to look for infection. We want to look for change in medication. But it's not any of those. Now what? Talk to the family. Is there a change in that they haven't been visiting? Or is there a change that they've noticed? What else? Check her feet. What else? What was that? Check her hearing. Maybe. Maybe she's not hearing the music. Anybody else? Did she fall? There's no falls. Check her shoes. Okay, those seem to be okay. Did she lose her dance partner? No, that's not it. Quite a group. What else? Fecal impaction, check her bowels, that's not it. Because we're not having that in our facility. It's on my list of things we're not having. Dehydration, we're not having that either. Come on, there's one more thing y'all are missing. It's not that she's depressed, it's not her eyes. She can't get there? No, that's not it. X-ray, what are you going to x-ray? Total body x-ray. Folks, look at her diagnoses. Look at her. Is there a reason to believe that she could have pain? And I will tell you, way back in Rita's chart, we found a diagnosis of arthritis. She was getting Tylenol every day for her pain, but now suddenly didn't seem to be working. We needed to change the intervention. Look at diagnosis. Always look at, is there a reason to believe the individual could have pain? Is arthritis a stable disease process? How about degenerative joint disease? How about osteoporosis? How about spinal stenosis? We expect to see changes, and so we need to look at that. Always look at diagnosis. Is there a reason to believe pain could be the reason? Ken, look at the behaviors we talked about in Ken. Refusing to ambulate, difficulty sleeping, refusing to eat, only picking at his food and beating up his caregivers. So what would you all do with Ken? How many of you are calling psych? How many of you are calling psych for Ken? Haldol, Risperidol, Zyprexa, Seroquel, Ativan, Xanax, drug of choice. That's what we tend to do. We need to look further. Now, in the ideal world, the goal of pain management would be to make pain go away. Nowhere are we living in a more real world than in long-term care today. And so the goal of pain management is, in fact, to make pain manageable. Not to make pain go away, not to have a pain rating of zero, but to make pain manageable so it doesn't interfere with activities of daily living and quality of life. And that's what we care plan for. I like to ask my residents, what would you like to be able to do that you can't do now because of your pain? And the answer might be, I want to get back to activities. I want to do my needlework. I'd like to be able to sleep through the night. Or I'd like to dress myself. Or I'd like to walk to the bathroom without any of you coming with. These are our residents' individualized comfort function goals for pain management. And that's what we care plan for. We use the principles and science of the World Health Organization, WHO analgesic ladder, to do this. This ladder was originally designed for use for the management of cancer pain. And in the years since that ladder was designed, it's been extrapolated for use in chronic and non-cancer pain as well. Step 1 in the WHO analgesic ladder deals with mild pain. We utilize non-pharmacologic interventions, heat, cold, massage, exercise, adaptive equipment. We also utilize non-opioid analgesics, things like acetaminophen and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And acetaminophen, plain old Tylenol, really is our drug of choice for mild pain, maybe even moderate pain, right? Because it's a really safe drug, we can give it as often as we want and as much as we want, right? No. What do you mean? What's the maximum amount of acetaminophen we can give to a relatively healthy individual in a day? Oh, this group is good. 4 grams. For individuals who have no major organ dysfunction, no renal insufficiency, no major medical problems and comorbidities, 4 grams. What about the individual who has major organ dysfunction, renal insufficiency, and multiple comorbidities? What's the maximum amount we can give to that and those individuals? I hear 2 grams. I hear 3 grams. Anybody want to phone a friend? 2.5 grams. 2.5 grams. Now, I want you to think about some of the residents in your facility who are getting 650 milligrams of acetaminophen every 4 hours around the clock. That would be 4 grams. And I want you to think about whether all of these individuals who are getting 4 grams really should be getting 4 grams. You may find that many of your residents who are taking a lot of acetaminophen are taking more than they should be. If somebody's got liver disease, we want to avoid Tylenol, acetaminophen. One of the other things that we need to be aware of, and we're seeing more and more studies about this, do you have any residents who are on Coumadin? Yeah, 1 or 2 or 62, right? What we are finding is acetaminophen in higher doses, high doses, can be the cause of anticoagulation instability. So when you have somebody who's on Coumadin and you keep taking their Coumadin level, you keep doing the PTINR and you're increasing the Coumadin and decreasing the Coumadin and up and down and up and down and up and down on a daily basis, look at how much Tylenol they're taking. Tylenol may be the reason you're having difficulty. Let the doctor know how much Tylenol that resident is getting. You may reduce your lab bill because you don't have to keep drawing the labs if you get them off some of this acetaminophen. So look at Tylenol as the cause of anticoagulation instability. Your docs will think you're a hero. They'll think you're a genius. Also, for step one in the WHO analgesic ladder for mild pain, we utilize non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Traditionally, we've used traditional non-steroidals, things like ibuprofen, Motrin, and Naprosyn. We need to be aware of these drugs because they are the number one cause of adverse drug reaction in the elderly. Number one. They have a multitude of side effects and drug interactions. They have renal effects. They have platelet effects. Elderly individuals who are placed on traditional non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are 4 times more likely to develop peptic ulcer disease and 5 times more likely to die as a result of a GI bleed. So what about the newer non-steroidals, the COX-2s, Celebrex, Vioxx, Bextra? They're okay, right? They have less GI effects, not none, and they still have the renal effects. What the COX-2s don't have is the platelet effects. So actually, if you have somebody who's pre-op for surgery, you don't have to stop a COX-2. If you have somebody who's post-op from surgery, they can have a COX-2 inhibitor. Those are the big differences. But they have less GI erosion, not none. So we still need to be aware of the potential for bleeding when we utilize non-steroidals, even the COX-2s. Step 2 in the WHO analgesic ladder deals with moderate pain or pain that's not controlled by step 1 interventions. Here we add an opioid to the pain management regimen. Opioids are the main class of medication used for the treatment of moderate to severe pain, even in the elderly, even in the cognitively impaired. Opioids are the main class of medication used for the treatment of moderate to severe pain. Opioids are often safer for use in our elderly than non-opioids. Historically, at step two, we've utilized combination products, things like Percocet, Lortab, Vicodin, Tylox. They're a combination of an opioid and a non-opioid. That non-opioid is usually acetaminophen. So again, you have to be aware of how much acetaminophen your residents are getting. Again, we think about adjuvant analgesics for neuropathic pains, pains coming from abnormal processing of sensory inputs. Step three is pain that continues, increases in severity, or is uncontrolled by step two intervention. We treat this with increasing opioid dosages and increasing opioid potency. Again, we think about adjuvant analgesics. And this is the first place where we think about more invasive modalities. This is the first place where we should be thinking about, do we need to make a referral to a pain management specialist? Do we think we need a nerve block? Are we looking at implanted pumps here? We shouldn't be looking at those more invasive modalities until we get to step three in the WHO analgesic ladder. When we talk about opioid analgesics, and we're going to talk about them as a class of medication, they have common properties and mechanisms of action, and our commonly and frequently utilized opioid analgesics include morphine, hydromorphone, which is Dilaudid, hydrocodone, which is the opioid in Lortab and Vicodin, oxycodone, which we can utilize as a pure opioid, oxycodone, or we can use as a combination product in things like Percocet or Tylox, codeine, which we traditionally use as Tylenol number 3, and fentanyl, which is the opioid in the Duragesic patch. All of these have similar mechanisms of action, and they have similar side effect profiles. We need to talk about side effect management when we talk about opioid analgesics. The most common and pervasive side effect from opioid use is what? Constipation. Is, has been, and always will be. Tolerance to the constipating effects of opioids doesn't go away. So I have a little policy in my facility. You're going to like this. The hand that writes for the opioid, that doesn't write for the bowel routine, is the one that has to do the disimpaction. I've never had to tell my docs that more than once. It works. If you put somebody on an opioid, put them on a bowel routine. By the way, on the subject of bowel routines, Colace is not a bowel routine. Colace is a stool softener. Colace will give you mush. When you put somebody on an opioid, you need a stimulant laxative, something that will give a push. Be aware of this. Side effect management. Nausea, you may see in your residents when you first start opioid use. Nausea that you see with opioid use is transient. First 48 to 72 hours. Sometimes we just need to get the resident over the hump. We might need an antiemetic. If you've got somebody who's a real thrower-upper. They throw up when you serve meatloaf. They throw up if if there are two Tuesdays in a month. They throw up if you look at them cross-eyed. They throw up with any medication. This is somebody you might want to order an antiemetic right off the bat when you start them on opioids. For most of my residents, I will tell you, because we start low and we go slow and we titrate to effect, for most of my residents, it's not an issue. One of the other things that you have to be aware of when we talk about side effect management, we talk about opioids, and I deal with this a lot in my facility. Everything that ever happens to any of my residents who are on opioids is the fault of the opioids. Not because this is real, but because that's the perception. If they sleep late, it's the opioids. If they don't sleep, it's the opioids. If they're nauseous, it's the opioids. If they have a headache, it's the opioids. If they have a temperature, it's the opioids. If they were nasty to the staff, it's the opioids. If they fought with their daughter, it's the opioids. If they didn't match their socks right, it's the opioids. Are you getting my point here? Uh-huh. We're going to talk more about this. But nausea you may see. Find out if it really is the opioid. I'll tell you a story about something that happened in my facility, and I really hate to admit this, but I will. because it demonstrates a point. I had a resident who I started on opioid analgesics. She had really severe pain from a wound on her leg. She had a diabetic ulcer on her leg, and she had really severe pain. And we started her on opioid analgesics. And I got a call the next day from one of my nurses saying, I called the doc and I had it discontinued because she was really nauseous. And I said to this nurse, I said, yes, I know she's really nauseous. She's been really nauseous for a week. We started this med yesterday. So do you all think it was the med? We need to think about this. But I will tell you, your staff is going to be uncomfortable. They're going to be nervous. And anything that happens with your resident will be the fault of the opioids. We need to assess. We need to manage side effects. We need to look at really what is related to the opioids and what is not. If the nausea is related to the opioids, it's the first 48 to 72 hours. Hang in there. Get your residents through it. Confusion. I generally don't see this, again, because we start low and go slow and titrate to effect. But in your cognitively impaired residents, how do you know whether they're confused because of opioids or whether they're confused because they're confused? The answer is you actually know, don't you? You know what's baseline for your residents. Are they their normal confused? Or is there something different? It's one of the luxuries we have in long-term care. Sedation. We may see sedation when we first start somebody on an opioid. Again, it's the first 48 to 72 hours. This is a transient effect. Sedation is actually a very important indicator, and we're going to talk more about it in just a moment. But if you start low, go slow, and titrate to effect, you may never see sedation. Respiratory depression. How common is respiratory depression from opioid use, do you think? Not very at all. Yet respiratory depression is the most feared side effect from opioid use. And it is not uncommon that I will have nurses say to me, I don't want to be responsible for giving that last dose of morphine. So I'll turn around and I'll ask the nurse, because we really do need to change the way we think in terms of pain management. Do you want to be the nurse responsible for giving that last dose of morphine? Or do you want to be the nurse responsible for that patient dying in pain because you didn't? We need to change the way we think. We need to change the way we view these medications. Now, in terms of respiratory depression and sedation, the two really are closely linked. If you monitor for level of sedation, you will never see respiratory depression. It takes less of an opioid to cause sedation than it does to cause respiratory depression. So here's the deal. If you actually look at your resident, not a pulse oximeter, look at the resident and monitor for level of sedation, you'll never see respiratory depression. Let's talk about how we monitor level of sedation. This is Margo McCaffrey and Chris Passaro's sedation scale, and I really like this scale because it's easy to use. S is sleeping and easily aroused. If the person's getting good analgesic effect, leave them alone. If they're getting inadequate pain management, increase their analgesia. Increase their opioid analgesics. Sleeping has nothing to do with sedation. We sleep every day, most of us. Level one is awake and alert. Well, that's most of you. And if you were on opioid analgesics for pain management and you were getting good pain relief, I wouldn't touch your analgesic pain management regimen. If you were getting inadequate pain management, I'd call the doc and ask for an increase. Level two is occasionally drowsy, easy to arouse. If you're getting good pain management, I wouldn't change it. That's some of you. And if you're on opioids for pain management and you're getting good analgesic effect, don't change it. If you're getting inadequate pain management, we can still increase the opioid. Increase it slowly, but at level two, you can still increase. Level three is frequently drowsy, arousable, drift off to sleep during conversation. I don't think that's any of you in here. I hope not. If you have somebody at level three and they're getting good pain management, this is where we stop the opioid. If they need more analgesia, we don't add more opioid. We add other analgesics. We add non-opioid analgesics. We add adjuvant analgesics. We utilize non-pharmacologic interventions. At level 3, we don't increase. Level 4, somnolent, minimal or no response to stimuli. Okay, now if you want to get concerned, you can get a little concerned. If this individual is on end-of-life care, if they're getting palliative care, if they're getting hospice care, don't worry about this level 4. You stop the opioid here, but you don't need to reverse. If this is a young adult who you've just started on opioids and they're a rehab patient and we've got them somnolent now, okay. Now if you want to talk to me about sending them out to the hospital, you can talk to me about sending them out to the hospital. How many of you have Narcan in your facilities? I do not have Narcan in my facility, and I'll tell you why. First of all, if you've got somebody who's at level 4, you don't want them staying in your facility if it's this young adult subacute rehab patient. Narcan administration is a skill. What you do when you administer Narcan is put somebody into withdrawal, which is very painful, can cause cardiac arrhythmias, and can kill somebody. You don't want to do this to your residents. If you administer Narcan in your facility, you're administering at IM, aren't you? It takes about 30 to 40 minutes to peak effect. You want to be hanging out with this person you're concerned about for 30 to 60 minutes? No. This is the person you want to send out, 911. Let the paramedics deal with it. They can give the Narcan IV, which works immediately. Make sure you have really good policies if you have Narcan so we're not putting our patients into withdrawal. Be really careful with this drug. Like I said, I don't even keep it in my facility. And we've discussed it a number of times. The medical directors, the medical board, and myself, we don't have Narcan. Make sure you're not reversing people who are on end-of-life care. These are folks that if they get to level 4, you may need them at level 4. Does that make sense? Okay. But pain management is not just about medications. Good pain management is about utilizing pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic interventions to manage pain. Our non-pharmacologic interventions include incorporating physical and occupational therapies, heat, cold, massage, TENS units, adaptive equipment, positioning devices. My recreation staff has a wonderful guided imagery and aromatherapy program that we utilize. We do guided imagery 5 days a week. This is wonderfully received by my residents. We can make referrals for acupuncture and acupressure. Medicare covers it. Medicaid does not. And some HMOs cover. Some private insurances cover. Therapeutic touch. And my personal favorite in the realm of non-pharmacologic interventions, comfort food. There is nothing and no one you can't make better given enough chocolate. Now, granted, chocolate doesn't make the pain go away, but it definitely makes your residents feel better. You need to find out what works for your residents. How many of you, after a bad day, go home and have a glass of wine, a cup of tea, a box of cookies, or a pint of ice cream? Or all of the above? And how often do you do this for your residents? And how often do your residents have a bad day? Think about this. I walk around with chocolate in my facility all the time. I have every kind of chocolate you can imagine. My dietitian and I, we do a little battle about this, but one little Hershey's Kiss or one little tiny Mr. Good bar is really not going to hurt even my diabetic patients. Think about comfort measures. Think about things we do for ourselves. Think about what we can do to make our patients feel better. You have an 82-year-old resident with chronic back pain in your facility. You have one or two of those? Not out of the realm of possibility. And he's getting opioid analgesics for the management of his pain. He's reporting good pain control. But you go in tomorrow morning and your staff tells you he's reporting acute shortness of breath. What do you all think? Physical assessment, I heard somebody say. How many of you think respiratory depression? No. Okay, look at his diagnosis, do an assessment, listen to his lungs, check his vital signs. You all okay with that? Okay, let me ask you a question. How many of you are going to do the assessment, have your nurse practitioner do the assessment, have your doc do an assessment for change in condition? How many of you are going to do that? All of you, I hope. Okay. How many of you are going to, using nursing judgment, discontinue the opioid? I hope none of you. How many of you are going to continue the present pain management regimen? Good. The answer is A and C. Shortness of breath, acute shortness of breath, has nothing to do with respiratory depression. But I give you my word that you will have individuals in your facility, nurses, physicians, clinicians, and other healthcare providers who see shortness of breath in an individual on opioids who think it's the opioid. Advocate for your residents. And remember, shortness of breath is not respiratory depression. Does pulse oximetry tell us anything about respiratory depression? No. I'd actually like to throw out all the pulse oximeters in my facility. Pulse oximetry tells you in that exact second what the person's O2 sat is. So if they take a deep breath, it'll go up. If they hold their breath, it'll go down. It's a great toy. My kids love it when they come into my facility. They put it on their finger and they go, and they make the numbers go up and down. It doesn't tell us anything about respiratory depression. Level of sedation is the only thing that tells us anything about respiratory depression. Mrs. B is receiving acetaminophen for pain related to degenerative joint disease. She's been reporting a decrease in the effectiveness of her pain meds. What would you all do? Assessment? What else? Find out how much Tylenol she's taking? What else? Change the pain medication? Anybody else? See what else is going on with the individual that might be increasing the pain? I'm sorry, what was it? Is there an exacerbation in the pain? Does she also have a UTI? What else is going on? Did she have a fall? How many of you would continue pain medications because Tylenol really should be adequate analgesia? No. How many of you would get a psych consult because she's probably drug-seeking? No. No, huh? How many of you would evaluate for a change in condition? Is something else medical going on? Good. How many of you would consider an increase in analgesic potency? Excellent. We need to plan care for our residents. A comprehensive problem statement starts all of our care plans, and we get that from our pain assessment. So if we were to go back to Mrs. H, remember Mrs. H? Our problem statement might read, Mrs. H is 94 years old. She has degenerative joint disease of her left hip, the pain of which is interfering with her ability to ambulate. We set goals, individualized comfort function goals. The goal for Mrs. H would be for her to ambulate 200 to 300 feet 3 times a day. Is my goal measurable? I think so. Now we need a plan of care. So what are our interventions to meet just that goal? Not every goal in the whole world for her, not everything we're trying to do. Just for her to walk 200 to 300 feet 3 times a day. We're going to use pharmacologic interventions. Maybe she needs some analgesics. And we're going to include non-pharmacologic interventions. Maybe she needs PT. Maybe she needs hot packs. Maybe her nutrition and hydration need to be looked at. Can we evaluate the effectiveness of my plan of care? Can we evaluate whether or not I've met my goal? This is a great care plan. I'm really good, am I not? This is what we need to do. This is what a pain management care plan needs to look like. Care plans aren't written in stone. You all know that. So we need to update the plan of care as needed. And one of the things that I have found particularly helpful in my facility in terms of adjusting the plan of care is morning report. I don't know how many of you in your facilities have a department head meeting in the morning. How many of you have that in your facilities? It is a wonderful way to improve care to our residents and communication. And I will, during my morning report, on the supervisor's report, we put a notation of who is on the pain management program, who I need feedback about pain from. So while I have PT sitting there, OT sitting there, rec, dietary, nursing, while everybody's sitting in the same room, they can tell me whether or not the plan of care for Mrs. H has been working and what they've been seeing. And while in my ideal world, PT would go and write a pain note and rec would go and write a pain note, the reality is they're probably not going to do it. But if I'm getting this information from PT and rec, when I go and write my note, I can say, rec reports resident has increased her participation in activities. PT is reporting no discomfort during ambulation. OT reports an increased number of reps using the pulleys. So we have interdisciplinary documentation and input. Documentation on an ongoing basis has to evaluate the plan of care. And I strongly advocate that you don't duplicate documentation. So if all of your pain documentation is in the care plan, don't also write it in the nurse's note. What I do frequently in my care plan, that's where I do all my pain documentation. I'll reference a PT note. I don't have to copy everything they wrote. I can write CPT note 102803. Don't duplicate. If you're using a flow sheet to document pain,